Hey, hey, podcast family. Well, we've all heard during pregnancy that it's okay to eat for two. I mean, after all, I mean, the baby needs food, right? I mean, severe caloric restriction like famine is linked to altered fetal growth. Yes, that's true. Although most of the altered fetal growth with famine, while caloric restriction definitely does have a role, it's probably not just that. It's the stress of living through a famine. But it all goes to show that there's a lot of misunderstandings and misperceptions about caloric intake during pregnancy. So eating for two is okay as long as it's healthy. And the rules for eating and weight gain during pregnancy are controversial. They've always been controversial. Even back in 2013, when ACOG first released committee opinion number 548, it states that the recommendations for weight gain in pregnancy are a bit controversial, especially for those who are overweight or obese. Well, there's a brand new publication that came out in The Lancet just, about a week ago. This came out on March the 28th, 2024. And as point of reference, I'm doing this on April the 2nd, 2024. This new publication from The Lancet is a population-based cohort study that actually asked this question, and it's a good question. Hey, in those patients who are obese, whether that's class 1 obesity, class 2, or class 3, what happens when they don't meet the old Institute of Medicine, the IOM, now called the National Academy of Medicine? What happens when those in those weight categories do not meet the recommendations for weight gain? Is there an altered fetal response? Is there bad maternal and neonatal outcomes? So we're going to talk about this in pregnancy because we've known this for a long time, but this is validation that in those patients who have class 1, 2, or 3 obesity, we really need to pull the reins back on eating for two. The idea is not about eating for a certain amount of weight gain. It's about eating healthy to have good nutrition during pregnancy, because weight gain during pregnancy, as everybody gets, becomes weight that is difficult to lose postpartum. So this is a good publication that is calling into question something that historically has been out for a long time. The original recommendations for weight gain in pregnancy from the IOM were in 1990, and they were even more allowable for weight gain than the current guidelines that we have now that were revised in 2009. So it's the IOM weight gain in pregnancy per BMI classification from 2009 that we are still using today. We're going to talk about these guidelines in this episode. Plus, I'm going to give us a really easy way to remember the current IOM recommendations for pounds gained during pregnancy based on initial BMI. Okay, whether somebody is underweight, normal weight, overweight, or obese, I'm gonna give you an easy way to remember the total pounds recommended for weight gain at this time during pregnancy. Although, like everything else, just like this steroid saga that we just covered in our last podcast, things are brewing and there's changes that may be coming. So we're going to talk about that, especially again in class 1, 2, and 3 obesity based on this population-based cohort study. And since we're talking about obesity, we're also going to revisit something that we've covered many times in this podcast as well, which is negative pressure wound therapy at C-section. Because last month, out of the Pink Journal, AJOG-MFM, there was yet another study that has looked at best practice for C-section performance in patients who have obesity. Okay, so we're going to highlight this specifically regarding negative pressure wound therapy. The title of this separate publication, again, out of the Pink Journal, is Peripartum Interventions for People with Class 3 Obesity, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. So two papers we're going to highlight here. All right, guys, one is The Lancet talking about suboptimal, according to the IOM's current guidelines, suboptimal weight gain when obesity is already present. And then we're going to talk about C-section in those with class 3 obesity. And to be fair, we're going to round that out and talk about obesity in general, meaning a BMI of 30 or above. So class 1, I'm also going to touch on specifically regarding negative pressure wound therapy. It's still a thing. People like their little negative pressure wound vac, but is that evidence-based? So it's a little touchy because people really like their use of that vacuum. But some of the data is going to surprise you. All right. So two papers we're going to cover: weight gain in pregnancy so that we can eat for two. No, so we can eat healthy for two. And then we're going to talk about negative pressure wound therapy with obesity with this new publication from The Pink focusing on class 3 obesity. All right. Get your healthy snacks and let's talk about eating healthy during pregnancy. Here we go. Just trying to keep everyone up to date on evidence-based practice because medicine moves real fast. This is Clinical Pearls.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I don't think the surgery is working like it should. It just doesn't make sense.
What you're saying is what doesn't make sense. Let me explain something to you. You started out hoping in a magic fix, and then you applied yourself and took control for a few months until you got weight loss surgery, and then your emotional issues came to the surface. And dealing with that is really hard stuff. And now you're hoping in a magic fix for that. And until you take your psychotherapy seriously and do what you need with that, this trend and direction you headed is going to continue. And if that happens, you're not going to make it. So you have a very important choice to make. Whether you want to turn your life around or make excuses and end up eating yourself to death. You got it?
Okay, I'm sure you know who that is. But if you don't, that is a physician out of my home state of Texas who is a gifted bariatric surgeon. But he's also savage. I mean, savage. And at some point, and now that's old school medicine, okay? Because this guy's a little older and just tells it like it is. And so there really are two camps here for Dr. Now out of Houston, who has the TV show or had the TV show some time ago. I don't know if it's still on, but it's called My 600-Pound Life. The two camps are, oh my gosh, he just tells me like it is. I needed a tough love and he put me on the right direction. And then the other camp is, what an ass. Can you soften the blow a little bit? And there's really nothing in the middle. I mean, there really are this dichotomy for this bariatric surgeon. And I think that there's a place for both. I mean, there's coddling and, you know, and kind of condescending to the patient, and at some point we just need to hold people accountable for actions. The tough thing with weight and with eating is that it is both a biological need. I mean, we get hungry. We got to do something about that, and it's highly psychological. The issue of satisfying or filling a void of some type, whether it's depression or anxiety or whatever, loneliness, boredom. With food is real. We know that. I mean, and this is why some weight loss surgeries fail. This is why diets fail, right? Because they work in the short term. But if we don't change the underlying issue, guys, what is it that leads to the overeating? Is it a previous abuse? Is it the endorphin rush of food that we're trying to make up for something else? Who knows? And I have to tell you, guys, I mean, I've never been obese, but I was overweight by most standards in college for a little bit of time. Again, never obese, but definitely overweight for my height because I'm pretty darn short. And I felt it. And I was miserable and I didn't like it. Until I said, one day I had enough. I said, this is it. I'm done. And I quickly dropped it with behavioral changes, you know, dietary restriction. And I just started to walk more. So yes, it can be done. But and the reason I'm talking about this is because we're talking about obesity, all right? So I wanted to give the open door here right at the beginning, that we have to understand where patients are coming from. It's not just, oh, they're lazy. Oh my gosh, look how fat they are. We never know what's behind the story. So that's the first thing we have to keep in mind is, what is going on? I mean, nobody wakes up and goes from a BMI, you know, of 18 to 40. In 2 weeks. I mean, something has happened here. And so what is that? Is food being a crutch for something? Is it an endocrine issue? I mean, who knows? There are some chromosomal issues, especially in severe obesity, like in childhood, like under the age of 5 or 6. And if there's massive obesity, you got to do a chromosomal evaluation to see if there's some kind of chromosomal issue / metabolic condition. That is legit. So my point is, and the only reason I wanted to include that little clip from Dr. Now, not a sponsor, is to be respectful and aware that, man, it's tough what these patients go through. Then with pregnancy, that's a whole other issue, all right? So being overweight is one thing. Being obese, whether it's class 1, 2, and 3, brings all of its other set of issues because there's pre-gestational diabetes or gestational diabetes, hypertensive disorders of pregnancy, the potential for some growth alteration abnormalities, and all of these things, and in preterm labor, all of these things are real with pregnancy in the patient who has obesity, okay? So remember, I'm trying to be aware of my language, not say the obese patient, just like not saying the diabetic patient, because those are not correct. We have to put it correct, the words correct here. Semantics mean things. So the patient with obesity. So if I slip and say the obese patient, sorry guys, I'm trying to be cognizant of it. All right. Having said that, we're going to focus on two issues here. One is the old Institute of Medicine guidelines, and I mean old because they are old. They were out from the 90s. But more importantly is that the Institute of Medicine isn't even a thing anymore. I mean, that doesn't even exist. The Institute of Medicine changed its name to the National Academy of Medicine some time ago. And just if you're interested, as a little useless trivia, there are actually three, right? There are three academies for the U.S. These are national organizations. They're very prestigious. You know, people walk around with their little medals. I look at my medals. My medals are shiny. Okay. So, yeah, as you can tell, I've never been invited, but there's three academies here for the United States. The first is the National Academy of Sciences. The second is the National Academy of Engineering. And then the third is the National Academy of Medicine, right? So the National Academy of Medicine, the term is relatively new, although it's the old Institute of Medicine that started in 1970. Okay, so the institution, the name is different, but IOM has been there for a long time. The reason we're talking about this is because one of the three national academies here in the States, which is the Academy of Medicine, drafted these original rules when it was the IOM, the Institute of Medicine. See, this is why medicine gets confusing, because things change their name and you're like, who's who? What's that? I mean, so the National Academy of Medicine, NAM, is not to be confused with NAMS, which was the previous name of the current Menopause Society, because NAMS is the North American Menopause Society, now called Menopause. So IOM is now called NAM, and NAMS is now called the Menopause Society. Menopause is not what we're talking about today. Okay, I'm done with that rant. Also, if there's a weird echo, I am doing this on the fly. I'm in between locations, and I cannot get myself to go to our podcast studio today. I just can't do it. I'm just not feeling it. But I wanted to get this out, so I'm doing this remote. So if there's a weird echo, I'll have Mike try to equalize that sound. If not, oh well, we'll roll with it. But anyway, we're talking about, let's focus first again on weight gain during pregnancy. So let's go back to ACOG, right? Everything has circles around. What does ACOG say, SMFM, or professional guidance? Well, ACOG's original committee opinion, that was 548. That's the original, came out January 2013, 11 years ago. 11 years ago. What's our whole tagline here? Medicine moves fast. January 2013. Now, it wasn't looked at by the college back then and left. I mean, it was reaffirmed last year. Okay, so this is why the years also get confusing, because you're like, wait, you're quoting something from January 2013. Wait a minute. This periodically goes through revision. It goes through its own internal analysis by ACOG, by a committee. And if there's nothing to change, it earns a little parentheses underneath it and says, hey, we took a look at this again, and there's really nothing to change here, so we're going to keep it the same. And that was done last year in 2023. So it was reaffirmed. But in this original committee opinion, it does go through the Institute of Medicine's weight gain classification, what's recommended based on BMI. And I'm going to address that next. But even back here, it states that these weight gain recommendations are pretty controversial. And this really was expert opinion trying to balance appropriate nutrition and large for gestational age and potential risks like preterm birth. So this was based on, yes, it was based on some data, but really it was consensus opinion when this first came out in the 90s, okay? So let me give you the recommended range of total weight gain. This recommended, it doesn't mean they have to, it's just recommended, based on BMI. And so first, let's read you the BMI so everybody remembers. Remember, normal weight is 18.5 to 24.9. All right, 18.5 to 24.9 is normal BMI. Overweight then is above that. So 25 to 29.9 is overweight. And of course, obesity, all classes, is 30 and greater. And then you have category 1 or class 1 obesity, class 2, and then class 3. Class 3 is typically a BMI of 40 and above. All right. So normal BMI 18.5 to 24.9. And then underweight is less than that. So anything less than 18.5 is underweight. Okay, so that's BMI. Now, here's what's interesting about this, because these recommendations, and it's right here strictly from the college, this is regardless of age, parity, smoking cessation, race, or ethnic background, right? So let me read it directly from here. Quote, the IOM revised gestational weight gain guidelines are based on pre-pregnancy BMI, for underweight, normal weight, overweight, and obese women recommended by the World Health Organization and are independent of age, parity, smoking, race, and ethnic background. Okay, so you're like, well, what's the big deal? Why did I stop and talk about that for age? Because it's interesting, because technically BMIs aren't really used for like the adolescent population. Adolescence, because there's still growth going on and there's changes in muscle mass, it's typically used as a percentage of age norms for weight. And then based on those percentages, patients are classed as an adolescent outside of pregnancy as normal weight, overweight, or obese, right? So adolescence is done a little bit different. So pediatrics, if you're family medicine, right, it's while there are some BMI guidelines, it's mainly based on a percentage, what is up to the 95th percentile for expected weight for age, all right? But this is what's interesting, because if you have an adolescent who's pregnant, then you defer back to these IOM recommended guidelines because now they're pregnant. So BMI has some issues in adolescence, but when you're pregnant, this doesn't have any exclusion clause. It's like right now you must recommend these. And this is the issue, is that some of these came out of, as we just stated, consensus opinion, and maybe the weight gain, especially on overweight and especially, of course, with obese, that's excessive. Excessive weight gain, allowing what the IOM currently recommends, man, it's tough to get rid of that. And so the question is, are we pushing patients? I hate to use that word, but are we allowing patients, I guess, or permitting patients? Are we giving them a pass to be a little bit more unhealthy? Wow. Does that make sense? Think about that. That's a big charge here. Now, let me give you the recommended weight gains, and I'll talk about where these numbers come from, all right? And I think I've touched on this in past episodes, but it's really interesting. But in short, so remember, we just covered BMI strata, right? Normal is 18.5 to 24.9. Underweight is anything less than that. And then overweight is 25 to 29.9. Obese is 30 and more. So the recommended weight gain, guys, it always start with normal. So in the normal BMI, 25 to 35, 25 to 35. Now, here's what I learned as a medical student, and it's still true today based on this criteria from the IOM recommended norms back from the 90s. Okay. So here it is, super easy. For normal weight, if your BMI is 18.5 to 24.9, the recommended weight gain is 25 to 35. If you are overweight, then you reduce that by 10. So the recommended is 15 to 25. So 25 to 35 for normal BMI minus 10 goes to 15 and 25. If it's obese, so even more than that, then you drop that by 5. So you go from 15 and 25 pounds for overweight class to what's recommended in obese of 10 to 20. All right, so you start at 25 to 35, and if you are overweight, then you drop that by 10, and if you're obese, you drop from that number by 5. Okay, super easy, right? Now, if your normal weight with a BMI of 18.5 to 24.9, the recommended weight gain, as we've already said, 25 to 35. But if you're underweight, you need to gain more. So in that case, you go up by 5. So it becomes basically 30 to 40. Does that make sense? So it's a super easy way. If you always remember 25 to 35 is a recommended weight in pregnancy for normal weight gain in pregnancy, then if you are overweight, you drop that by 10. And if you're obese, you drop down from that number by 5. And if you're underweight, then you start at 25 to 35. Always start with a normal BMI. And in the underweight class, you add 5 to that. So it basically becomes 30 and 40. All right, everyone, I do need to clarify, because the Institute of Medicine did release the original writing. I'm looking at it right here. It was called the Committee on Nutrition Status and Pregnancy and Lactation, that gave these guidelines for weight gain and pregnancy back in 1990. All right, everyone, just to clarify, the original rules in 1990, that's when the weight gain recommendations in pregnancy first came out. But then in 2009, the IOM actually wheeled back. They actually put the reins on a little bit on what was originally allowed, right? So 2009 is what we're using still today. So look how this changed. I don't want to harp on this too much, but look how there has been some progress, although it's been slow. So in 1990, the original weight that was allowed in overweight women based on BMI, all right, back in 1990, it was 26 to 29 pounds. Remember, now overweight women are allowed a weight gain of 15 to 25. But originally, it was 26 to 29. So in 2009, they're like, yeah, that's pretty excessive. Let's bring that down to what it is now. So for overweight women, 15 to 25 pounds. That's from 2009. Also, at that time, they took away weight gain in what they called special populations. We're not going to get into that. And they also added in 2009 the increased weight gain that's allowable for twin gestations. For twin pregnancies, the Institute of Medicine recommended a weight gain of around 37 to 54 pounds for women of normal weight. How about that? 37 to 54 pounds for women of normal weight. 31 to 50 pounds for overweight women. And for obese women with twins, it dropped to 25 to 42 pounds. It's a lot, right? So that was the 2009 revision. This new publication that we're highlighting, that we haven't even gotten to yet, that came out in The Lancet, this is in singleton women, right? Not twins. So this were singleton women's prospective cohort study, and they all had obesity, class 1, 2, or 3 obesity. All right, everyone, we got to get this show moving. So when we come back, let's tackle this new publication from The Lancet, the title of which is Safety of Low Weight Gain or Weight Loss in Pregnancies with Class 1, 2, and 3 Obesity, a population-based cohort study from The Lancet, which came out March 28th, 2024. Thank you for being part of our podcast family. We really are grateful and thankful that you've chosen to take this journey of medical education with us. You're listening to Clinical Pearls.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Podcast family, what do we always say on this episode? Yes, medicine moves fast, but it's not that one. It's that nothing is new under the sun. And once again, if I was Sarah Comstock, who was the author who wrote in the Journal of Clinical Medicine this publication, quote, "Time to Change Weight Gain Recommendations for Pregnant Women with Obesity," end quote, back in 2009, again, I would say, what the hell? I mean, well, why is this Lancet publication? Yes, it's population cohorts. It's a big number. Why did that get all the press when I wrote the same thing November 2019? Guys, nothing new under the sun. 5 years ago, I'm looking at it right here, the Journal of Clinical Investigation, Sarah Comstock, "Time to Change Weight Gain Recommendations for Pregnant Women with Obesity." And the whole take-home message from this publication is they're overcalling it. Yes, 2009, it got better from 1990. It pulled the reins back a little bit, but it is still excessive when this weight is difficult to lose. And are we allowing, basically giving patients a green pass card to, hey, just gain more weight? Because, you know, they're eating for two. So again, even though this publication came out from the Lancet just last week, the concept is that this has been controversial for a long time. 5 years ago, Clinical Journal of Investigation, this whole issue of what do we allow for overweight and pregnant women, what was being called into question. So again, nothing new. There's plenty of data out there that they do not need to gain that much additional weight in pregnancy to avoid adverse outcomes. Actually, what this new publication from The Lancet shows is that, especially in class 3 obesity, when they gain minimal weight gain have minimal weight loss. Again, so be clear, I'm not advocating for people to get weight loss surgery in pregnancy or immediately before pregnancy. Remember, they're supposed to have some time from weight loss surgery to pregnancy to allow for nutritional deficiencies to correct and let stress of surgery resolve, or else you're going to get a double whammy with nausea, vomiting, and the other issues that pregnancy brings in the immediate peri-op period. So I am not saying, hey, if you want to get pregnant, have weight loss surgery, and then immediately get pregnant. That's absolutely not what I'm saying. I'm saying that it's okay, especially in the obese classification, to not meet the current IOM/National Academy of Medicine recommended weight gains safely. So you can be below that and not doom the pregnancy, okay? So, and now we have evidence for that. But I just thought this was interesting. Back in 2019, where this publication goes through great literature review, it goes through energy metabolism in pregnancy. It's a really nice publication that, and people have been whistleblowing for this for a long time. Guys, we're letting women gain too much weight, especially in the overweight and in the obese population. Okay, now I'm sure I've done this in a previous episode because I remember this, but here's where this 2009 recommendation for weight gain in pregnancy surrounds and comes from, right? Remember, obese, all classes, so that's a BMI of 30 or more. The recommendation by the IOM is basically 10 to 20 pounds, right? 10 to 20 pounds. And it makes sense when you think about where the weight is coming from pregnancy itself. So let's do quick math here. Let's assume baby weighs just a flat 7 pounds. Yes, I know there's some are 7.5, some are 8, some are 6. I'm just trying to give you the math here, guys, of where in the obese classification, where that 10 to 20 pounds comes from, what it looks like, okay? So baby, you have 7. You have the enlarging uterus with the hypertrophy of the muscle. That's about another 2 pounds. So far we're at 9. The placenta is about another 1 to 2 pounds. So that's 10 to 11. Amniotic fluid is about another 2 pounds. So what do we have there? About 13. Breast enlargement, about another about a pound per breast. So that's another 2 pounds. So see, we're about 15. And then the extra blood volume, let's say on average about 5 pounds or so. So if you put it all together, you're between 10 and 20 pounds. Did you get that? So the idea of the weight gain allowed in pregnancy, the additional weight above the mom's baseline pre-pregnancy BMI of 10 to 20, that's allowed total pounds, okay, in the obese classification, was to take into account, just like you just added all the pregnancy stuff on top of mom. Okay, so that makes sense. Y'all get that? If you add the weight of each breast, the uterus, blood flow, extra blood volume, the baby itself, the placenta, the uterus, it all comes down to somewhere with some variance, because people's blood volume is different based on height. Baby is a different weight based on a lot of factors, nutrition, diabetes. You all get this, right? So that's why you get that 10 to 20 allowed. The idea is you're not really changing. The extra weight gain is just the baby stuff. What we now know is that's not true. Because some of those physiological changes, baby's weight gain, the additional of the breast, it can actually come at the expense of mom. In other words, as the baby is a parasite, so to speak, I don't mean that in an offensive way. Please don't send me an ugly message. I can't believe you called a baby a parasite. Ugh. Well, it's not symbiotic, that's for darn sure. What does the mom gain out of that? I mean, the baby is taking nutritional stores from the mom, iron stores, energy transport. There's a constant downward stream. That's the job of human placental lactogen, to get nutrients to the child. The baby functions as a parasite. So it is possible, and now this data from The Lancet, again, because it's not the first one, again, from March 2024, has showed that even if the mom kind of loses a marginal amount of weight, a small amount of weight, baby's getting theirs. Baby's going to be okay. And the physiological changes of pregnancy are going to happen just fine. Now that we've settled that, let's get into this new publication from The Lancet that's out of Stockholm, Sweden. This was a prospective cohort study that used birth data from the Stockholm Gotland perinatal cohort. This is amazing what you can do with a national database, okay? So authors looked at patients who delivered from January 2008 through December 2015. Now, if you're thinking, wait a minute, they stopped in 2015? Hey, they followed these patients for a median of 7.9 years. How about that? That's why you have to go all the way back to get 7 years of data. They looked at a composite of 10 outcomes: stillbirth, infant death, large or small for gestational age at birth, preterm birth, unplanned cesarean delivery, gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, excess postpartum weight retention, and they also looked at new onset long-term maternal metabolic diseases that happened after pregnancy. Okay, so in this cohort, remember, all patients had obesity of some class. So that's BMI of 30 or above before 14 weeks of pregnancy, so in the first trimester. And this was close to 16,000 pregnancies. 16,000. Actually, if you want the real number, it's 15,760. Okay, so just call it what it is. It's pretty darn close to 16,000. Now, it's not like these women were prevented from having another pregnancy in that time. About a third went on to have another pregnancy during that observation period. Now, most patients were in the obese class 1 category, which makes sense, right? Because as you get more and more obese, at one time it was called the super obese or morbid obesity, then the numbers tends to drop. So most were in class 1 with a BMI of 30 to 34.9. Class 2 obesity, which of course is a BMI of 35 to 39, were in the second biggest class. And then the smallest cohort, which was 933 patients, had class 3 obesity. Right, so the majority, which is close to 12,000, had class 1. About another 3,000 were class 2. And then just over 900 were in class 3 obesity. Remember, all marked by BMI in the first trimester before 14 weeks. Remember, the focus of study was in those who did not meet at least the 10 to 11 pound weight gain, which is the minimum weight gain allowed based on IOM classification, all right, for weight gain allowance for pounds based on BMI. So among these in the cohort, 13.9 of class 1, 24.9% of class 2, and 33.2% of class 3 gained less than that lower limit of the IOM recommendation. So a couple of things to take into account here. The amount of patients with class 1, 2, and 3 obesity got smaller as the level of obesity got worse. Right? That makes sense. So most were in class 1, then class 2, and then the least were in class 3. And oddly enough, the amount of weight gain was less as pregnancy got worse. So that's a good thing, all right? So class 1, 13.9% had below 11-pound weight gain. 24.9% had less than the 11-pound weight gain for class 2 obesity. And basically a third, 33% of those in class 3 obesity had less than the 11-pound weight gain a minimum that the IOM says to need. Remember, in our calculation of, or a quick math, it's 10 to 11 pounds. All right, guys, for sake of time, because we've still got to talk about negative pressure wound vacs at C-section in this population, very easy. What did they find? It's simple, that weight gain under the IOM minimum seemed to be all right. Actually, for those with class 3 obesity who gained below the IOM lower limit of weight gain, actually had a reduced rate of adverse composite outcome with a relative risk that's adjusted of 0.81. So yeah, they did better. All to say, it's all right. Patients who are obese, here's a take-home message, guys. Here's a clinical implication. Number one, we're probably allowing too much weight gain in the overweight and obese, definitely in the obese population. And while we should not caloric restrict them, we want them to eat healthy. They should have nutritional counseling, be due to their screen for gestational diabetes, of course. But if they don't hit the marks, that's okay. And just to clarify, when we mean weight loss, we're not talking about those, they like drop 50 pounds. That's not what we're talking about here, okay? We're talking about hovering to their first trimester weight or going down just minimal drops. So these are not like they lost 20 pounds, okay? As the author state, quote, these findings suggest that a low amount of weight gain or weight loss is safe in pregnant women with obesity and might even be beneficial for those with class 3 obesity. So I have to clarify. Remember, this publication was not in those in the BMI class of overweight. It is only for those with obesity. So class 1, 2, or 3. So anything above BMI of 30 and above. Because I know I've mentioned here that we're probably allowing too much weight gain even in the overweight population. But then that extrapolation is still true because previous commentaries, even though this Lancet publication is only in obesity, class 1, 2, and 3, others have shown that with even those who are overweight, we could probably hang onto the lower end of recommended weight gain very safely. All right? Because again, the baby's going to get their nutrition from the stores of mom. And as long as mom eats healthy, we don't want excessive weight gain. So I want to be very clear. This Lancet publication focused on BMIs of 30 and above, 1, 2, and 3 obesities, and found that not going beyond the 11 in that population seemed to be okay. Does that make sense? So this was not an overweight women. It focused only on obesity. But by extrapolation, the same can be said for those who are overweight. Not that they should be on a diet. That's not what I'm saying here, and that's not what these authors stated here or what the prior commentary in 2019 stated. It's about eating nutritionally well and not eating to a target weight gain, but eating well in pregnancy, especially in the obese population. Before we leave this publication and just briefly touch on negative pressure wound therapy in patients with obesity. And again, we're going to focus on obesity as a class, including class 1. So class 1, 2, and 3 from the Pink Journal. But I do love how the authors address this fear of, especially from patients. So, oh my gosh, if I don't gain enough weight, my baby's going to be small. Wait a minute here. There's a lot of factors that go into a small baby and whether that's pathologic or not. So let me read exactly as it's written by these authors in the Lancet publication because it's very eloquently stated in a very brief amount of text. Quote, small for gestational age birth is a statistical definition that does not necessarily imply pathology. 50 to 70% of small for gestational age births are estimated to be constitutionally small but healthy. Thus, it is unclear whether this outcome is sufficiently serious to outweigh the many adverse maternal outcomes that are associated with weight gain, end quote. Now, I'm not, again, to be clear, this is not weight gain in general. This is weight gain in the obese population. So, and I love this. When patients ask, my baby's just not going to grow that much, it's going to be okay. As Dr. Now would say from the show, you don't look malnourished. I mean, isn't that terrible? I mean, he tells patients who are not losing weight after their bariatric surgery, and they're like, I think I'm not eating enough. I think I'm malnourished. You don't look malnourished. Many, that's one of his savage statements. I'm trying to get us there in more tact, that the baby is definitely going to get theirs, because the baby will take your stores before it starves. So you may starve. Your baby's probably okay. And so that's something to consider. As our last quote from one of the authors of this publication. Look, guys, I told you that in the last episode where we talked about steroids, that there's a revolution going in obstetrics, right? We're finding a lot of stuff and doing things the old status quo, just because that's how we've always done it. This is the weight gain that we've always recommended. It doesn't have to be so. I mean, we can have data challenge our status quo and change things. Well, this is exactly what one of these authors commented in an interview regarding this publication. So let me read you this quote, and then we'll move on to negative pressure wound therapy. Let me spoil it for you here. It didn't seem to do anything. And not the first meta-analysis that has shown this. Dalk has several publications with Vincenzo Bergea on evidence-based C-section. And the take-home is, look, if you like negative pressure wound therapy, use it because you like it. But let's be real, the data doesn't seem to show it decreases wound infection in those with obesity. Okay, 1, 2, or 3, even in class 3 obesity with BMIs over 40, negative pressure wound therapy had no benefit over standard wound closure. And it didn't even matter if it was staples or suture, which even that is controversial, because in some past data, sutures seemed to have less risk of infection. But in this new review from March of 2024 in the Pink Journal, they're like, yeah, do whatever you want. I mean, just use good, the idea is good sterile technique and try to close dead space. But whether suture or staples, you know, really has a difference, it didn't seem to matter. And let me just spoil it here, even though we'll talk about it quickly. Negative pressure wound therapy did not matter, even in class 3 obesity. But back to this Lancet publication about weight gain. Now, it's this last quote, and then we'll leave it here. As the author comments in an interview, quote, our findings support calls to lower or remove, guys, that's a bold statement, not just to lower, but to remove the lower limit of current IOM recommendations for pregnant women with obesity, and suggest that separate guidelines for class 3 obesity are warranted, end quote. How about that? So they're like, hey, just take away that last category of 10 to 20 pounds and let's revise that. So obesity, class 1, 2, and 3, here's the new data. Instead of using the 2009 guidelines, which are over a decade old. Is that interesting or what? Now that we've made peace with that, let's jump over quickly, for sake of time, into the Pink Journal, the title of which is Peripartum Interventions for People with Class 3 Obesity, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. All right, everyone, very quickly, in a nutshell, here is the findings from the systematic review and meta-analysis from the Pink Journal. And I'm just going to give it to you quick, since we're talking about this thing about management of pregnancy in those with obesity. Now, we talked about weight gain. Now, should a patient get a C-section? And if you're thinking about a negative pressure wound vac, knock yourself out. If you like it, you just want to use it because you think it's neat, fine. The question is, are you really reducing the risk of cellulitis and wound complication? Many published data, not just this one from last month in March 2024, have showed that it likely doesn't do it. Actually, one report showed an increased risk of surgical site infection in a retrospective study. How about that? And there's theories as to why that would be the case. So let me just read you quickly this synopsis, including that evidence of the increased risk in a retrospective study, and then we'll call it a day. Okay. So here's what the authors state. Quote, due to the high occurrence of surgical site infections in people with obesity, some centers support the use of negative pressure wound therapy, especially in people with higher BMIs. So we're talking about obesity, and especially in those with class 3 obesity. So the authors continue to state, quote, a systematic review and meta-analysis of prophylactic negative pressure wound therapy after C-section did not support its use in reducing a composite of wound complications among women with a BMI of or above 30. Now, they're talking about a previous publication. And here's the interesting part. Quote, furthermore, Buzhart et al. Reported an increased risk of post-op SSI with negative pressure wound therapy at 6.5% compared to 3% with standard closure in a retrospective cohort comprising 34% of people having class 3 obesity. So the short of it is, in this publication, as it relates to negative pressure wound therapy, they say, look, you can use either staples or suture. The data is kind of conflicting, not sure if one is better there or not. So while it's unclear if suture or staple is the way to go, it seems to be clear that negative pressure wound therapy after C-section for patients with all types of obesity, even BMIs over 40, really doesn't seem to reduce the risk of SSI and composite wound complications compared to standard closure. Whew, we covered a lot. All right, everybody, let's bring it home. All right, podcast family, that brings us to a wrap. As always, we're thankful for you, and we're glad you're part of our podcast community. We'll see you on another episode of Clinical Pearls. We'll be right back.